PRISM is one of six science instruments on MRO. And our relationship to the other instruments is an important feature, not just of our data set, but of how our data can be used together with data from other instruments. Mostly what we do is observe Mars' surface and characterize geologic features. When we do this, we often operate in coordination with two high-resolution imagers, the high-rise imager and the CTX imager. And so commonly what you'll find for regions of interest on the surface is what we call a coordinated observation, where there's data from two or three of the instruments together. We also are an atmospheric instrument, observing aerosols and trace gases in the atmosphere. And the MARSI and MCS instruments, MARSI is a visible wavelength camera, and MCS is a mid-infrared sounder. We operate together with them when we're operating in that mode. So the co-analysis of the data sets, if you're an atmospheric scientist, the instruments of interest would be MARSI and MCS. Next slide. Okay. A brief overview of how the instrument works, because this is going to be important to your understanding why we do certain things to the data. The guts of the instrument are a camera and optics that sit inside of here. The optics can sometimes view the planet, and we also can view two different types of internal calibration sources. We have a shutter that we take for dark measurements, and an internal integrating sphere that we use for radiometric calibration. This is radiator here on the side of the instrument that faces the, towards the terminator. It keeps the optics cool to minimize the self-glowing of the instrument. And the whole thing is mounted on a gimbal that pivots back and forth in the plane ground track, allowing us to point and track a location on the surface and pick up pitch motion smear and build up long integration times. There's a couple of electronics boxes that go with the instrument. The one of more interest is called a data processing unit. And what it allows us to do in real time is bin and edit the data. So in electronics, we can change what's inherently a high-resolution hyperspectral imager to a lower-resolution multispectral imager and bang down our data volume enough to do global mapping. Next slide. So this is a diagram of the inside of the optics. Here's the telescope looking out at the planet. And when the light comes in, there are two things to pay attention to. One of them is that there is a shutter which directs which way we're looking, into the integrating sphere or out of the scene, or if we turn the integrating sphere up, we can get dark measurement. This shutter is very important in understanding how we process the data, and in particular an artifact that occurred in the last version of the data that had been released that is now corrected in the new release of the data. And secondly, there are two wavelength ranges in the instrument, two different detectors, so it's almost really like you've got data from two separate instruments that we have to scale to each other and then merge together in order to produce a product that covers the full wavelength range of the instrument. And to date, there's been quite a focus by the community analyzing the data on the infrared part of the data. In the products that we're now releasing, you get the whole wavelength range and don't have to worry about merging them yourself. Next slide. Now, an individual readout of the detectors looks like this, where you get an image in which one direction is one line of the spatial image, and the other direction is the spectrum. And so a spectrum is a column out of here. And what you see here is the vnear, or 0.4 to 1 micron wavelength range, and the near infrared from 1 to 3.9 microns. And these brackets indicate zones on the detector where there's actually a physical filter that blocks light of an unwanted wavelength in that part of the detector. And the boundaries between these end up being wavelengths where the calibration can be somewhat suspect, and you'll hear more about that later. Next. Now, in order to build up a full image cube, we take a whole succession of frames, like the ones you just saw, and stack them up, one on top of another, representing minutes of outputting those frames at a frame rate of anything between 3.75 and 30 hertz to build up an image where you have a two-dimensional coverage of the surface in the third dimension being the spectrum. And just pull like a drill core from any spatial pixel a spectrum out of there that can be compared with mineral analogs measured in the laboratory. Next. Okay. How we configure the instrument controls what type of observations that we take. Most important configuration that we can choose is whether to fix that gimbal pointing at nadir or to actively track a point on the surface. And when we do that, we call that a targeted observation because we're targeting a particular point on the surface. We also vary the number of wavelengths we use. For targeted observations, we're typically doing 544 wavelengths with useful data. But in a global mapping mode, we can pick a fewer number of channels. And what we do is we have different menus that cover the key wavelength ranges. And we've taken a global map in 72 wavelengths. We've taken about 20% of the planet in 262 wavelengths, which is contiguous coverage over all the key infrared absorptions due to hydrated minerals in flight. We have other configurations that we can choose, frame rate and spatial pixel bidding, and these are basically used to square off the pixels in the data. Next. Okay, and this shows the pivoting back and forth of the instrument, and this is one of the key mechanical operations that we do, and we're not immune to MACPC errors. Next. So we've been operating now for close to 5 years, and we take observations now that we weren't taking at first, and we take some of the ones that we used to take differently. And there are three reasons for this. First of all, is that Mars is just way more interesting than anybody would have believed before we started taking our measurements in orbit. So we've augmented some of the data acquisition modes to include things like hyperspectral mapping, 200 meters per pixel. That wasn't something we had originally planned on doing. The second thing is that we've taken on an increasing role among the MRO instruments in monitoring the atmosphere. We, back in 2007, developed and added a new kind of observation to provide greater time and spatial sampling density of water vapor and trace gases in the atmosphere. And in 2009, we started observing the planet's limb, getting high-resolution vertical structure. The final reason for some changes is quite simply the hardware is aging. And back in 2010, we discovered that we had a sticky region in the gimbal's scan range. And since September 2010, we've avoided that aging range, and I'll explain how that's changed our observations. And there are cryogenic coolers that keep the infrared detector cold enough to have low noise and be able to see the planet through the noise background of the detector. The cooler operation has gotten more difficult to manage over time, and one of the things that we've had to start doing for the last 3 years is occasionally power cycle the coolers to clear a frozen carbon dioxide in the refrigerant. And every time we do this, we're using something from a finite budget of on-off cycles, and we don't know what that number is before we cause some electronics to fail. So what we do is we operate the IR detector intermittently, and we'll take the full wavelength range of data and then take just visible beam 0.4 to 1 micron data part of the time. And the MRO planning cycle has been adjusted to cram all of the interesting prism observations into the time period when we're operating cold. Types of observations. So here's the basic anatomy of a carbonate observation. This occurs over a time period of about 7 minutes, and you can see it in terms of kilometers up and down range from your target point on the surface, as well as seconds from the overflight of that target. In blue, we take 5 images as we're approaching the target. You see these here map projected. And then as we overfly it, we take 1 image where we scan across the target very slowly and build up the high-resolution image that most people are interested in analyzing. And then finally, as we're flying away from the target, we look back and take five more images whose footprints are shown here in red. The central image may be without any pixel binning or with 2x binning. Those are geology images. We occasionally take them with 10x binning if all we're interested in is looking at the scattering properties of atmospheric aerosols. The first five and the last five are only there to characterize aerosol scattering properties. So those are always 10x binning. I mentioned a sticky region in the gimbal. Since September 2010, we have omitted the five incoming emission phase function images. So we end up with, instead of 11 images per observation, 6 images per observation, the high-resolution central scan, and the 5 bin OCO images. Next slide. Now, depending upon how we choose to bin and square off pixels, we have 3 different types of central swaths. We name the observation using a nomenclature that's based on the configuration of the central swath. A full resolution target with no binning, a half resolution short target where we just take data for half the time, and a half resolution long target where we do 2x binning but take data for just as long a period of time. And what the half resolution long does is give us coverage, and half resolution short is a tool to manage the data volume. When you superimpose the emission phase function observations on any of these, you get coverage of a larger area. Since March of last year, we've been experimenting with something that we call long track over sampled observations, or ATOs, where we overlap the lines of the image in the long track direction. And this allows recovery of higher resolution than the native resolution of the instrument using super resolution light processing techniques. We're not going to talk about that today, but it is out there, and that the full utilization of those would be the next major upgrade to the data set. And beginning this June, when we release data to the PBS, we'll start releasing a table of which observations are configured in this way. Next slide. Another type of gimbaled observation we take is when we look at the limb. And we do this for a group of 2 to 3 orbits about every 2 months. And this is what you get, where the scale bar is shown at the top. It's really along the height of the observation, 500 kilometers. And you can see the detached limb hazes. And if you're interested in clouds, you can recover very interesting information on particle size and composition from that. Next. Okay, the second basic type of observation is nadir looking, and we take this as really long strips of data where we map the planet by wrapping a string around each pole. And we've taken most of the planet in 72 wavelengths as a succession of 3-minute segments, and the 72 colors are clustered at the wavelengths of key mineral absorptions, at least that we knew about going into orbit, sulfates and phosphosilicates. And these noodles are mosaics to create global map. Next. Now, as time has gone on, we've expanded the wavelength range of these to better address carbonates, which weren't very well addressed in the initial selection of multispectral wavelengths. So we have a 3-letter nomenclature that tells you the kind of mapping observation we're taking. The MSPs are the multispectral data that we've mapped the planet with. We started taking HSPs, which are hyperspectral over the region of 0.4 to 2.5 microns, and selected wavelengths to help beyond that. HSVs are Wiener only equivalent for when we're not running the cooler. We still want to take data. Long ago, we used to take little segments at 100 meters per pixel of visible in near-infrared data. We called those multispectral windows. For technical reasons, we discontinued those in 2008, but we brought them back in their Wiener-only form. And starting with MROs next, starting actually this month, we're starting to build up 100 meter per pixel 92 wavelength full Wiener coverage to map out iron mineralogy at times when the coolers aren't running. And we'll be doing that over MROs next season of the mission. And for the atmospheric monitoring, we take these little bursts of data called TODs. Next. Okay, current observing plan. Three big questions we've always been addressing. Finding targets of interest and putting them into context with global mapping. Second, characterizing the atmosphere and separating it from the surface. Third, measuring targets with high spectral and spatial resolution. What's in red are the types of observations that are new that we didn't used to do that we've introduced over time. And most of these you would not have heard about at the first data users workshop. So these are all things out there. When we're done figuring out the best we can do with the targeted observations, our next job is to do a better job with these additional types of mapping observations and upgrade our global map products. Next. In terms of coverage and amount of data, we're currently at 77% of the planet in both Wiener and IR wavelength ranges with low atmospheric capacity. We're close to 90% in Wiener. Next. For atmospheric observations, this shows our coverage with latitude on the y-axis and solar longitude or time on the x-axis. And what's shown here in false color is the retrieved abundance of water vapor in the atmosphere. And from the density of the plot, you can see key events in the life of the spacecraft, like where we introduced the little burst of hyperspectral data or the TODs. And then you can also see the coverage get more spotty when the infrared operation became more intermittent. Next. And finally, the targeted observations, which is mainly what we're talking about today. We've got over 21,000 of them. Over 15,000 are at full resolution and 6,000 at half resolution. And the white ovals on there indicate the areas of greatest concentration where the largest interesting mineral outcrops occur. Okay, so a targeted observation, as I've already explained, is taken as a collection of observations. And this is the really raw stuff right as it comes out of the detector at the EDR level. It's a high-resolution central image. These are all shown at the same scale of pixels. Highly bin, 5 incoming, 5 outgoing images, and then dark measurements that bracket them. And next slide. When the gimbal got sticky, in order to preserve the nomenclature and make the data set not even more confusing to use, is we just replace those incoming EPFs with dark images, and they become complicit in the calibration process. Next. The standard product that people are generally working with is the calibrated data, and these are TRDRs, and that stands for Targeted Reduced Data Records. And we deliver them in two flavors. One of them is at the radiance on sensor, watts per square meter per steradian per micron. And an ASCII table for each line in the image with key instrument housekeeping items, which for some purposes, for some few users, is useful information to have. The product that most people are using is I over F data, which is relative to solar irradiance and unitless multiband image. Each has a PDS label that goes with it describing the configuration of the data that the Prism Analysis Tool, or CAT, reads in order to understand how to load up the observation into imagery. Next slide. This is one of those slides that's there for your reference to come back to if you have a question. This describes how the slides are named. This is the little decoder ring in order to understand it. But the file name actually fully describes the type of data, which detector it came from, whether it's Wiener or IR, what version of the processing, and this unique 8-character ID, like a social security number that goes with each observation that we take. Next slide. Accompanying the TRDR, this is something called a DDR. And it has geometric information for every pixel in the image, including latitude, longitude, incidence emission, phase angles, map projection, and photometric correction, plus some value-added information like elevation, slope, magnitude, and azimuth that goes into higher-order analyses of the data. And this is in the same sensor space as the data, one-for-one correspondence spatially with the TRDR, and a PDS label that goes with it describing what every band of the data is and how it relates back to its parent observers. Next. And once again, here's the decoder ring for the DDR, something to go back to for reference when you want to understand what's in the file name. Once again, it completely describes what the data is and where it comes from. And the main usage of the DDRs is this. You combine it with a TRDR, and it allows you to map projected data. And today, you'll hear about some of the uses that those other plates get put to. Next. Okay. Now, this is the CAP. It runs as an extension to Envy. It can open and display prism images, apply standard corrections, and produce summary parameters. The following is a very brief summary that I'm just going to fly through to describe what typically people in the community have been doing. This has mostly been pre-applied to the process that we're rolling out today. Next slide. When it's installed, it opens up with an extra menu, an extra item in the Envy menu for CAT specific operations. Next. There's a specific tool to open a Prism file that knows how to read the labels and load things properly into Envy. Next. Typically, what somebody would do is perform a photometric correction and an atmospheric correction using what we call the scaled volcano, the volcano scan correction. And these are the steps that you walk through. Next. And the way the volcano scan works is from a ratio of the summit and the base of the Olympus Mons, you get a spectrum that is scaled in log space to the prism spectrum based on the characteristic shape and strength of the feature in the 2-micron region. You need to divide that out. Next. And also calculation of standard spectral indices or summary products. These are all things that are out in the CAP and are going to are pre-applied in the derivation of the MTRDRs. Next. And finally, map projection of the data using the DDRs. Next. Okay. We have a new tool called JCAT, which is available at the PRISM website. There are ITAR issues, so it's password protected. And you contact this individual to get access to the site. It is a stripped down version of Envy. The good thing is it costs nothing. It has some of the CAT capabilities that's good at the high school to junior college level. And it's been being used specifically by people who are high school students doing advanced projects. Next.
3 minutes.
Okay. So here's a screenshot. Next. And you can also access data via the PDS Geosciences Node or the PRISM website. I'm just going to skip over that and leave that for references. Yeah, there is a handout describing how to get the data from the PDS. So let's just blow through these slides. The URL is in the package, and you can refer back to this to understand how to use the various buttons to navigate. Most of you have probably done this. Like I said, this is a refresher for anybody who might not have been here last time. Right?
That's it.
Questions?
One of my colleagues in London was